didn't. You know, I swear it wasn't me. You who carried our secrets into the limelight, the fashionable one, the marquis in the white gloves, the fiend in the velvet cape. You're mad to blame it all on me. You have no right, I insisted, but my voice was faltering so badly I couldn't understand my own words. And his voice shot out of him like the tongue of a snake. We had our Eden under that ancient cemetery, he hissed. We had our faith and our purpose, and it was you who drove us out of it with a flaming sword. What do we have now? Answer me. Nothing but the love of each other, and what can that mean to creatures like us? No, it's not true. It was all happening already. You don't understand anything. You never did. But he wasn't listening to me. And it didn't matter whether or not he was listening. He was drawing closer, and in a dark flash his hand went out, and my head went back, and I saw the sky and the city of Paris upside down. I was falling through the air, and I went down and down past the windows of the tower, until the stone walkway rose up to catch me, and every bone in my body broke within its thin case of preternatural skin. 2 years passed before I was strong enough to board a ship for Louisiana, and I was still badly crippled, still scarred. But I had to leave Europe, where no whisper had come to me of my lost Gabrielle or of the great and powerful Marius, who had surely rendered his judgment upon me. I had to go home, and home was New Orleans, where the warmth was, where the flowers never stopped blooming, where I still owned through my never-ending supply of coin of the realm a dozen empty old mansions with rotting white columns and sagging porches round which I could roam. And I spent the last years of the 1800s in complete seclusion, in the old garden district a block from the Lafayette Cemetery, in the finest of my houses, slumbering beneath towering oaks. I read by candle or oil lamp all the books I could procure. I might as well have been Gabrielle trapped in her castle bedroom, save there was no furniture here, and the stacks of books reached to the ceiling in one room after another as I went on to the next. Now and then I mustered enough stamina to break into a library or an old bookstore for new volumes, but less and less I went out. I wrote off for periodicals. I hoarded candles and bottles and tin cans of oil. I do not remember when it became the 20th century, only that everything was uglier and darker, and the beauty I'd known in the old 18th century days seemed more than ever some kind of fanciful idea. The bourgeois ran the world now upon dreary principles, and with a distrust of the sensuality and the excess that the ancient regime had so loved. But my vision and thoughts were getting ever more clouded. I no longer hunted humans. And a vampire cannot thrive without human blood, human death. I survived by luring the garden animals of the old neighborhood, the pampered dogs and cats, and when they couldn't be got easily, well, then there was always the vermin that I could call to me like the Pied Piper, fat, long-tailed gray rats. One night I forced myself to make the long trek through the quiet streets to a shabby little theater called the Happy Hour, near the waterfront slums. I wanted to see the new silent moving pictures. I was wrapped in a greatcoat, with a muffler hiding my gaunt face. I wore gloves to hide my skeletal hands. The sight of the daytime sky, even in this imperfect film, terrified me. But it seemed the dreary tones of black and white were perfect for a colorless age. I did not think about other immortals. Yet now and then a vampire would appear, some orphaned fledgling who had stumbled on my lair, or a wanderer come in search of the legendary Lestat, begging for secrets, power. Horrid, these intrusions. Even the timbre of the supernatural voice shattered my nerves, drove me into the farthest corner. Yet no matter how great the pain, I scanned each new mind for knowledge of my Gabrielle. I never discovered any. Nothing to do after that but ignore the pure human victims the fiend would bring in the vain hope of restoring me. But these encounters were over soon enough. Frightened, aggrieved, shouting curses, the intruder would depart, leaving me in blessed silence. I'd slip a little deeper away from things, just lying there in the dark. I wasn't even reading much anymore. And when I did read, I read the Black Mask magazine. I read the stories of the ugly nihilistic men of the 20th century, the grey-clad crooks and the bank robbers and the detectives, and I tried to remember things. But I was so weak. I was so tired. And then early one evening, Armand came. I thought at first it was a delusion. He was standing so still in the ruined parlour, looking younger than ever with his short auburn cap of 20th-century hair and narrow little suit of dark cloth. It had to be an illusion, this figure coming into the parlour and looking down at me as I lay on my back on the floor by the broken French window, reading Sam Spade by the light of the moon. Except for one thing. If I were going to conjure up an imaginary visitor, it certainly wouldn't have been Armand. I glanced at him, and some vague shame passed over me, that I was so ugly, that I was no more than a skeleton with bulging eyes lying there. Then I went back to reading about the Maltese Falcon, my lips moving to speak Sam Spade's lines. When I looked up again, Armand was still there. It might have been the same night, or the next night, for all I knew. He was talking about Louis. He had been for some time. And I realized it was a lie he'd told me in Paris about Louis. Louis had been with Armand all these years, and Louis had been looking for me. Louis had been downtown in the old city, looking for me near the townhouse where we had lived for so long. Louis had come, finally, to this very place, and seen me through the windows. I tried to imagine it. Louis alive. Louis here, so close, and I had not even known it. I think I laughed a little. I couldn't keep it clear in my mind that Louis wasn't burnt up. But it was really wonderful that Louis still lived. It was wonderful that there existed still that handsome face, the poignant expression, that tender and faintly imploring voice, my beautiful Louis surviving, instead of dead and gone with Claudia and Nicky. But then maybe he was dead. Why should I believe Armand? I went back to reading by the moonlight, wishing the garden out there hadn't gotten so high. A good thing for Armand to do, I told him, would be to go out there and pull down some of those vines, since Armand was so strong. The morning glory vines and the wisteria were dripping off the upstairs porches, and they blocked out the moonlight, and then there were the old black oaks that had been here when there was nothing but swamp. I don't think I actually suggested this to Armand, and I only vaguely remember Armand letting me know that Louis was leaving him, and he, Armand, did not want to go on. Hollow, he sounded. Dry. Yet he gathered the moonlight to him as he stood there, and his voice still had its old resonance, its pure undertone of pain. Poor Armand. And you told me Louis was dead. Go dig a room for yourself under the Lafayette Cemetery. It's just up the street. No words spoken. No audible laughter. Just the secret enjoyment of laughter in me. I remember one clear image of him stranded in the middle of the dirty, empty room, looking at the walls of books on all sides. The rain had bled down from leaks in the roof and melded the books together like papier-mâché bricks, and I noticed it distinctly when I saw him standing there against the backdrop of it. And I knew all the rooms in the house were walled in books like this. I hadn't thought about it until that moment, when he started to look at it. I hadn't been in the other rooms in years. It seems he came back several times after that. I didn't see him, but I would hear him moving through the garden outside, looking for me with his mind, like a beam of light. Louis had gone away to the west. One time, when I was lying in the rubble under the foundations, Armand came to the grating and peered in at me, and I did see him, and he hissed at me and called me Rat-Catcher. "You've gone mad, you, the one who knew everything, the one who scoffed at us. You're mad and you feed on the rats. You know, in France in the old days, what they called your kind, you country lords, they called you hare catchers, because you hunted the hare so you wouldn't starve. And now what are you in this house? A ragged haunt, a rat catcher. You're mad as the ancient ones who cease to talk sense and jabber at the wind. And yet you hunt the rats as you were born to do." Again I laughed. I laughed and laughed. I remembered the wolves, and I laughed. "You always make me laugh," I told him. "I would have laughed at you under that cemetery in Paris, except it didn't seem the kind thing to do. And even when you cursed me and blamed me for all the stories about us, that was funny, too. If you hadn't been about to throw me off the tower, I would have laughed. You always make me laugh." Delicious it was, the hatred between us, or so I thought. Such unfamiliar excitement, to have him there to ridicule and despise. Yet suddenly the scene about me began to change. I wasn't lying in the rubble, I was walking through my house, and I wore not the filthy rags that had covered me for years, but a fine black tailcoat and a satin-lined cape. And the house, why, the house was beautiful, and all the books were in their proper places upon shelves. The parquet floor glistened in the light of the chandelier, and there was music coming from everywhere, the sound of a Vienna waltz, the rich harmony of violins. With each step I felt powerful again, and light, marvelously light. I could have easily taken the stairs two by two. I could have flown out and up through the darkness, the cloak like black wings. And then I was moving up in the darkness, and Armand and I stood together on the high roof. Radiant he was, in the same old-fashioned evening clothes, and we were looking over the jungle of dark singing tree-tops at the distant silver curve of the river and the low heavens, where the stars burned through the pearl-grey clouds. I was weeping at the sheer sight of it, at the feel of the damp wind against my face, and Armand stood beside me with his arm around me, and he was talking of forgiveness and sadness, of wisdom and things learned through pain. "I love you, my dark brother," he whispered, and the words moved through me like blood itself. "It wasn't that I wanted vengeance," he whispered. His face was stricken, his heart broken. He said, "But you came to be healed, and you did not want me. A century I had waited, and you did not want me." And I knew, as I had all along, really, that my restoration was illusion, that I was the same skeleton in rags, of course, and the house was still a ruin. And in the preternatural being who held me was the power that could give me back the sky and the wind. "Love me and the blood is yours," he said. "This blood that I have never given to another." I felt his lips against my face. "I can't deceive you," I answered. "I can't love you. What are you to me that I should love you? A dead thing that hungers for the power and the passion of others? The embodiment of thirst itself?" And in a moment of incalculable power, it was I who struck him and knocked him backwards and off the roof. Absolutely weightless he was, his figure dissolving into the grey night. But who was defeated? Who fell down and down again through the soft tree branches to the earth where he belonged, back to the rags and filth beneath the old house? Who lay finally in the rubble, with hands and face against the cool soil? Yet memory plays its tricks. Maybe I imagined it, his last invitation, and the anguish after, the weeping. I do know that as the months passed he was out there again. I heard him from time to time just walking those old garden district streets, and I wanted to call to him, to tell him that it was a lie I'd spoken to him, that I did love him, I did. But it was my time to be at peace with all things. It was my time to starve, and to go down into the earth finally, and maybe at last to dream the gods' dreams. And how could I tell Armand about the gods' dreams? There were no more candles, and there was no more oil for the lamps. Somewhere there was a strong box full of money and jewels, and letters to my lawyers and bankers who would continue to administer these properties I owned forever, on account of sums I had left with them. And so why not go now into the ground, knowing that it would never be disturbed, not in this old city with its crumbling replicas of other centuries? Everything would just go on and on and on. By the light of the heavens I read more of the story of Sam Spade and the Maltese Falcon. I looked at the date on the magazine, and I knew it was 1929, and I thought, oh, that's not possible, is it? And I drank enough from the rats to have the strength to dig really deep. The earth was holding me. Living things slivered through its thick and moist clods against my dried flesh, and I thought, if I ever do rise again, if I ever see even one small patch of the night sky full of stars, I will never, never do terrible things. I will never slay innocents. Even when I hunted the weak, it was the hopeless and the dying I took. I swear it was. I will never, never work the dark trick again. I will just, you know, be the continual awareness for no purpose. No purpose at all. Thirst. Pain as clear as light. I saw Marius. I saw him so vividly that I thought, this can't be a dream. And my heart expanded painfully. How splendid Marius looked! He wore a narrow, plain, modern suit of clothes, but it was made of red velvet, and his white hair was cut short and brushed back from his face. He had a glamour to him, this modern Marius, had a sprightliness that his costume of the old days had apparently concealed. And he was doing the most remarkable things. He had before him a black camera upon three spider legs, and this he cranked with his right hand as he made motion pictures of mortals in a studio full of incandescent light. How my heart was swelling to see this. The way that he spoke to these mortal beings, told them how they must hold one another, dance, move about. Painted scenery behind them, yes, and outside the windows of his studio were high brick buildings and the noise of motor coaches in the streets. No, this isn't a dream, I told myself. It is happening. He is there. And if only I try, I can see the city beyond the windows, know where he is. If only I try, I can hear the language that he speaks to the young players. Marius, I said, but the earth around me devoured the sound. The scene changed. Marius rode in the great cage of an elevator down into a cellar. Metal doors screeched and clanked, and into the vast sanctum of those who must be kept he went. And how different it all was! No more the Egyptian paintings, the perfume of flowers, the glitter of gold. The high walls were covered with the dappled colors of the Impressionists, building out of myriad fragments a vibrant 20th-century world. Airplanes flew over sunlit cities. Towers rose beyond the arch of steel bridges. Iron ships drove through silver seas. A universe it was, dissolving the walls on which it was rendered, surrounding the motionless and unchanged figures of Akasha and Enkil. Marius moved about the chapel. He moved past dark, tangled sculptures, telephone devices, typewriting machines upon wooden stands. He set before those who must be kept a large and stately gramophone. Delicately he put the tiny needle to its task upon the revolving record. A thin and rasping Vienna waltz poured forth from the metal horn. I laughed to see it, this sweet invention, set before them like an offering. Was the waltz like incense rising in the air? But Marius had not completed his tasks. A white screen he had unrolled down the wall, and now from a high platform behind the seated god and goddess, he projected moving pictures of mortals onto the white screen. Those who must be kept stared mute at the flickering images, statues in a museum, the electric light glaring on their white skin. And then the most marvelous thing happened. The jittery little figures in the motion picture began to talk. Above the grind of the gramophone waltz, they actually talked. And as I watched, frozen in excitement, frozen in joy to see it all, a great sadness suddenly engulfed me, a great crushing realization. It was just a dream, this. Because the truth was, the little figures in the moving pictures couldn't possibly talk. The chamber and all its little wonders lost its substance, went dim. Ah, horrid imperfection. Horrid little giveaway that I'd made it all up. And out of real bits and pieces, too, the silent movies I'd seen myself at the little theater called the Happy Hour, the gramophones I'd heard around me from 100 houses in the dark. And the Vienna waltz, ah, taken from the spell Armand had worked upon me. Too heartbreaking to think of that. Why hadn't I been just a little more clever in fooling myself? Kept the film silent, as it should have been. And I might have gone on believing it was a true vision after all. But here was the final proof of my invention, this audacious and self-serving fancy. Akasha, my beloved, was speaking to me. Akasha stood in the door of the chamber, gazing down the length of the underground corridor to the elevator by which Marius had returned to the world above. Her black hair hung thickly and heavily about her white shoulders. She raised her cold white hand to beckon. Her mouth was red. "Lestat," she whispered. "Come." Her thoughts flowed out of her soundlessly in the words of the old queen vampire who had spoken them to me under Les Innocents years and years before. "From my stone pillow, I have dreamed dreams of the mortal world above. I have heard its voices, its new music, as lullabies as I lie in my grave. I have envisioned its fantastical discoveries. I have known its courage in the timeless sanctum of my thoughts, and though it shuts me out with its dazzling forms, I long for one with the strength to roam it fearlessly, to ride the devil's road through its heart." "Lestat," she whispered again, her marble face tragically animate. "Come." "Oh, my darling," I said, tasting the bitter earth between my lips. "If only I could." Lestat de Liancourt, in the year of his resurrection, 1984. Dionysus in San Francisco, 1985. 1. The week before our record album went on sale, they reached out for the first time to threaten us over the telephone wires. Secrecy regarding the rock band called The Vampire Lestat had been expensive but almost impenetrable. Even the book publishers of my autobiography had cooperated in full, and during the long months of recording and filmmaking, I hadn't seen a single one of them in New Orleans, nor heard them roaming about. Yet somehow they had obtained the unlisted number, and into the electronic answering machine they issued their admonitions and epithets. "Outcast, we know what you are doing. We are ordering you to stop. Come out where we can see you. We dare you to come out." I had the band holed up in a lovely old plantation house north of New Orleans, pouring the Dom Pérignon for them as they smoked their hashish cigarettes, all of us weary of anticipation and preparation. Eager for the first live audience in San Francisco, the first certain taste of success. Then my lawyer, Christine, sent on the first phone messages. Uncanny how the equipment captured the timbre of the unearthly voices, and in the middle of the night I drove my musicians to the airport, and we flew west. After that, even Christine didn't know where we were hiding. The musicians themselves were not entirely sure. In a luxurious ranch house in Carmel Valley, we heard our music for the first time over the radio. We danced as our first video films appeared nationwide on the television cable. And each evening I went alone to the coastal city of Monterey to pick up Christine's communications. Then I went north to hunt. I drove my sleek, powerful black Porsche all the way to San Francisco, taking the hairpin curves of the coast road at intoxicating speed. And in the immaculate yellow gloom of the big city skid row, I stalked my killers a little more cruelly and slowly than before. The tension was becoming unbearable. Still, I didn't see the others. I didn't hear them. All I had were those phone messages from immortals I'd never known. "We warn you. Do not continue this madness. You are playing a more dangerous game than you realize." And then the recorded whisper that mortal ears could not hear. "Traitor! Outcast! Show yourself, Lestat!" And if they were hunting San Francisco, I didn't see them. But then, San Francisco is a dense and crowded city, and I was sly and silent, as I had always been. Finally, the telegrams came pouring into the Monterey postbox. We had done it. Sales of our album were breaking records here and in Europe. We could perform in any city we wanted after San Francisco. My autobiography was in all the bookstores from coast to coast. The Rampire Lestat was at the top of the charts. And after the nightly hunt in San Francisco, I started riding the long length of Divisadero Street. I let the black carapace of the Porsche crawl past the ruined Victorian houses, wondering in which one of these, if any, Louis had told the tale of Interview with a Vampire to the Mortal Boy. I was thinking constantly about Louis and Gabrielle. I was thinking about Armand. I was thinking about Marius. Marius, whom I had betrayed by telling the whole tale. Was the Vampire Lestat stretching its electronic tentacles far enough to touch them? Had they seen the video films, The Legacy of Magnus, The Children of Darkness, Those Who Must Be Kept? I thought of the other ancient ones whose names I'd revealed. Mael, Pandora, Ramses the Damned. The fact was, Marius could have found me no matter what the secrecy or the precautions. His powers could have bridged even the vast distances of America, if he was looking, if he had heard. The old dream came back to me of Marius cranking the motion picture camera, of the flickering patterns on the wall of the sanctum of Those Who Must Be Kept. Even in recollection, it seemed impossibly lucid, made my heart trip. And gradually I realized that I possessed a new concept of loneliness, a new method of measuring a silence that stretched to the end of the world. And all I had to interrupt it were those menacing, recorded, preternatural voices which carried no images as their virulency increased. "Don't dare to appear on stage in San Francisco. We warn you. Your challenge is too vulgar, too contemptuous. We will risk anything, even a public scandal, to punish you." I laughed at the incongruous combination of archaic language and the unmistakable American sound. What were they like, those modern vampires? Did they affect breeding and education once they walked with the undead? Did they assume a certain style? Did they live in covens, or ride about on big black motorcycles, as I liked to do? The excitement was building in me uncontrollably. And as I drove alone through the night with the radio blaring our music, I sensed a purely human enthusiasm mounting in me. I wanted to perform the way my mortals, Tough Cookie and Alex and Larry, wanted to perform. After the grueling work of building the records and films, I wanted us to raise our voices together before the screaming throng. And at odd moments I remembered those long-ago nights at Renault's little theatre too clearly. The strangest details came back. The feel of the white paint as I had smoothed it over my face, the smell of the powder, the instant of stepping before the footlights. Yes, it was all coming together, and if the wrath of Marius came with it, well, I deserved it, did I not? San Francisco charmed me, subdued me somewhat. Not hard to imagine my Louis in this place. Almost Venetian, it seemed. The somber, multicolored mansions and tenements rising wall to wall over the narrow black streets. irresistible, the lights sprinkled over hilltop and vale, and the hard, brilliant wilderness of downtown skyscrapers shooting up like a fairy-tale forest out of an ocean of mist. Each night on my return to Carmel Valley, I took out the sacks of fan mail forwarded to Monterey from New Orleans, and I looked through them for the vampire writing. Characters inscribed a little too heavily, style slightly old-fashioned. Maybe a more outrageous display of supernatural talent in a handwritten letter made to look as if it had been printed in Gothic style. But there was nothing but the fervent devotion of mortals. "Dear Lestat, my friend Cheryl and I love you, and we can't get tickets for the San Francisco concert, even though we stood in line for 6 hours. Please send us 2 tickets. We will be your victims. You can drink our blood." 3 o'clock in the morning, on the night before the San Francisco concert. The cool, green paradise of Carmel Valley was asleep. I was dozing in the giant den before the glass wall that faced the mountains. I was dreaming off and on of Marius. Marius said in my dream, "Why did you risk my vengeance?" And I said, "You turned your back on me."
"That is not the reason," he said. "You act on impulse. You want to throw all the pieces in the air."
"I want to affect things, to make something happen," I said. In the dream I shouted, and I felt suddenly the presence of the Carmel Valley house around me. Just a dream. A thin, mortal dream. Yet something else. A sudden transmission, like a vagrant radio wave intruding upon the wrong frequency, a voice saying, "Danger, danger to us all." For one split second, the vision of snow, ice, wind howling, something shattered on a stone floor, broken glass. "Lestat, danger!" I awoke. I was not lying on the couch any longer. I was standing and looking towards the glass doors. I could hear nothing, see nothing but the dim outline of the hills, the black shape of the helicopter hovering over its square of concrete like a giant fly. With my soul I listened. I listened so hard I was sweating, yet no more of the transmission, no images. And then the gradual awareness that there was a creature outside in the darkness, that I was hearing tiny physical sounds. Someone out there walking in the stillness. No human scent. One of them was out there. One of them had penetrated the secrecy and was approaching beyond the distant skeletal silhouette of the helicopter, through the open field of high grass. Again I listened. No, not a shimmer to reinforce the message of danger. In fact, the mind of the being was locked to me. I was getting only the inevitable signals of a creature passing through space. The rambling, low-roofed house slumbered around me. A giant aquarium, it seemed, with its barren white walls and the blue flickering light of the silent television set. Tough Cookie and Alex in each other's arms on the rug before the empty fireplace. Larry asleep in the cell-like bedroom with a carnally indefatigable groupie called Salamander, whom they had picked up in New Orleans before we came west. Sleeping bodyguards in the other low-ceilinged modern chambers and in the bunkhouse beyond the great blue oyster-shell swimming pool. And out there, under the clear black sky, this creature coming, moving towards us from the highway, on foot. This thing that I sensed now was completely alone. Beat of a supernatural heart in the thin darkness. Yes, I can hear it very distinctly. The hills were like ghosts in the distance, the yellow blossoms of the acacias gleaming white under the stars. Not afraid of anything, it seemed, just coming. And the thoughts absolutely impenetrable. That could mean one of the old ones, the very skilled ones, except the skilled ones would never crush the grass underfoot. This thing moved almost like a human. This vampire had been made by me. My heart was skipping. I glanced at the tiny lights of the alarm box, half concealed by the gathered drapery in the corner. Promise of sirens, if anything, mortal or immortal, tried to penetrate this house. On the edge of the white concrete he appeared, tall, slender figure, short dark hair. And then he paused, as if he could see me in the electric blue haze behind the glass veil. Yes, he saw me.
And he moved towards me, towards the light.
Agile, travelling just a little too lightly for a mortal. Black hair, green eyes, and the limbs shifting silkily under the neglected garments, a frayed black sweater that hung shapelessly from his shoulders, legs like long black spokes. I felt a lump come up in my throat. I was trembling. I tried to remember what was important, even in this moment, that I must scan the night for others, must be careful. Danger. But none of that mattered now, I knew. I shut my eyes for a second. It did not help anything, make anything easier. Then my hand went out to the alarm buttons, and I turned them off. I opened the giant glass doors, and the cold, fresh air moved past me into the room. He was past the helicopter, turning and stepping away like a dancer to look up at it, his head back, his thumbs hooked very casually in the pockets of his black jeans. When he looked at me again, I saw his face distinctly, and he smiled. Even our memories can fail us. He was proof of that, delicate and blinding as a laser as he came closer, all the old images blown away like dust. I flicked on the alarm system again, closed the doors on my mortals, and turned the key in the lock. For a second I thought, I cannot stand this, and this is only the beginning, and if he is here, only a few steps away from me now, then surely the others too will come. They will all come. I turned and went towards him, and for a silent moment I just studied him in the blue light falling through the glass. My voice was tight when I spoke. "Where's the black cape and finely tailored black coat, and the silk tie and all that foolishness?" I asked. Eyes locked on each other. Then he broke the stillness and laughed without making a sound. But he went on studying me with a rapt expression that gave me a secret joy, and with the boldness of a child he reached out and ran his fingers down the lapel of my grey velvet coat.
"Can't always be the living legend," he said.
The voice was like a whisper that wasn't a whisper, and I could hear his French accent so clearly, though I had never been able to hear my own. I could scarcely bear the sound of the syllables, the complete familiarity of it. And I forgot all the stiff, surly things I had planned to say, and I just took him in my arms. We embraced the way we never had in the past. We held each other the way Gabrielle and I used to do, and then I ran my hands over his hair and his face, just to letting myself really see him, as if he belonged to me, and he did the same. Seems we were talking and not talking. True, silent voices that didn't have any words, nodding a little. And I could feel him brimming with affection and a feverish satisfaction that seemed almost as strong as my own. But he was quiet suddenly, and his face became a little drawn.
"I thought you were dead and gone, you know," he said. It was barely audible.
"How did you find me here?" I asked.
"You wanted me to," he answered.
Flash of innocent confusion. He gave a slow shrug of the shoulders. Everything he did was magnetizing me just the way it had over a century ago, fingers so long and delicate, yet hands so strong.
"You let me see you and you let me follow you," he said. "You drove up and down Divisadero Street looking for me."
"And you were still there?"
"The safest place in the world for me," he said. "I never left it. They came looking for me, and they didn't find me, and then they went away. And now I move among them whenever I want, and they don't know me. They never knew what I looked like, really."
"And they'd try to destroy you if they knew," I said.
"Yes," he answered. "But they've been trying to do that since the Theater of the Vampires, and the things that happened there. Of course, interview with the vampire gave them some new reasons, and they do need reasons to play their little games. And they need the impetus, the excitement. They feed upon it like blood."
His voice sounded labored for a second. He took a deep breath. Hard to talk about all this. I wanted to put my arms around him again, but I didn't.
"But at the moment," he said, "I think you are the one that they want to destroy. And they do know what you look like."
Little smile.
"Everybody knows now what you look like, Monsieur le Rockstar."
He let his smile broaden. But the voice was polite and low, as it had always been, and a face suffused with feeling. There had been not the slightest change there yet. Maybe there never would be. I slipped my arm around his shoulder, and we walked together away from the lights of the house. We walked past the great grey hulk of the copter, and into the dry, sun-baked field and towards the hills. I think to be this happy is to be miserable. To feel this much satisfaction is to burn.
"Are you going to go through with it?" he asked. "The concert tomorrow night?"
Danger to us all. Had it been a warning or a threat?
"Yes, of course," I said. "What in hell could stop me from it?"
"I would like to stop you," he answered. "I would have come sooner if I could. I spotted you a week ago, then lost you."
"And why do you want to stop me?"
"You know why," he said. "I want to talk to you."
So simple, the words. And yet they had such meaning.
"There'll be time after," I answered. "Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Nothing is going to happen. You'll see."
I kept glancing at him and away from him, as if his green eyes were hurting me. In modern parlance, he was a laser beam. Deadly and delicate he seemed. His victims had always loved him.
And I had always loved him, hadn't I? No matter what happened. And how strong could love grow if you had eternity to nourish it, and it took only these few moments in time to renew its momentum, its heat?
"How can you be sure of that, Lestat?" he asked.
Intimate, his speaking my name. And I had not brought myself to say Louis in the same natural way. We were walking slowly now, without direction, and his arm was around me loosely as mine was around him.
"I have a battalion of mortals guarding us," I said. "There'll be bodyguards on the copter and in the limousine with my mortals. I travel alone from the airport in the Porsche so I can more easily defend myself, but we'll have a veritable motorcade. And just what can a handful of hateful 20th-century fledglings do anyway? These idiot creatures use the telephone for their threats."
"There are more than a handful," he said. "But what about Marius? Your enemies out there are debating it, whether the story of Marius was true, whether those who must be kept exist or not."
"Naturally. And you? Did you believe it?"
"Yes, as soon as I read it," he said. And there passed between us a moment of silence, in which perhaps we were both remembering the questing immortal of long ago who had asked me over and over, "Where did it begin?" Too much pain to be reinvoked. It was like taking pictures from the attic, cleaning away the dust and finding the colors still vibrant. And the pictures should have been portraits of dead ancestors, and they were pictures of us. I made some little nervous mortal gesture, raked my hair back off my forehead, tried to feel the cool of the breeze.
"What makes you so confident," he asked, "that Marius won't end this experiment as soon as you step on the stage tomorrow night?"
"Do you think any of the old ones would do that?" I asked. He reflected for a long moment, slipping deep into his thoughts the way he used to do, so deep it was as if he forgot I was there. Had it seemed that old rooms took shape around him, gaslight gave off its unsteady illumination, there came the sounds and scents of a former time from outside streets. We two, in that New Orleans parlour, coal fire in the grate beneath the marble mantel, everything growing older except us. And he stood now a modern child in sagging sweater and worn denim, gazing off towards the deserted hills, dishevelled, eyes sparked with an inner fire, hair mussed. He roused himself slowly, as if coming back to life.
"No, I think if the old ones trouble themselves with it at all, they will be too interested to do that."
"Are you interested?"
"Yes, you know I am," he said, and his face colored slightly. It became even more human. In fact, he looked more like a mortal man than any of our kind I've ever known. "I'm here, aren't I?" he said, and I sensed a pain in him, running like a vein of ore through his whole being, a vein that could carry feeling to the coldest depths.
I nodded. I took a deep breath and looked away from him, wishing I could say what I really wanted to say, that I loved him. But I couldn't do that. The feeling was too strong. "Whatever happens, it will be worth it," I said. "That is, if you and I, and Gabrielle and Armand, and Marius are together even for a short while, it will be worth it. Suppose Pandora chooses to show herself, and Maya, and God only knows how many others. What if all the old ones come? It will be worth it, Louis. As for the rest, I don't care."
"No, you care," he said, smiling. He was deeply fascinated. "You're just confident that it's going to be exciting, and that whatever the battle, you'll win."
I bowed my head. I laughed. I slipped my hands into the pockets of my pants, the way mortal men did in this day and age, and I walked on through the grass. The field still smelled of sun, even in the cool California night. I didn't tell him about the mortal part, the vanity of wanting to perform, the eerie madness that had come over me when I saw myself on the television screen, saw my face on the album covers plastered to the windows of the North Beach record store. He followed at my side. "If the old ones really wanted to destroy me," I said, "don't you think it would already be done?"
"No," he said. "I saw you and I followed you. But before that I couldn't find you. As soon as I heard that you'd come out, I tried."
"How did you hear?" I asked.
"There are places in all the big cities where the vampires meet," he said. "Surely you know this by now."
"No, I don't. Tell me," I said.
"They are the bars we call the Vampire Connection," he said, smiling a little ironically as he said it. "They are frequented by mortals, of course, and known to us by their names. There is Dr. Polidori in London, and Lamia in Paris. There is Bela Lugosi in the city of Los Angeles, and Carmilla and Lord Riven in New York. Here in San Francisco we have the most beautiful of them all, possibly, the cabaret called Dracula's Daughter on Castro Street."
I started laughing. I couldn't help it, and I could see that he was about to laugh, too.
"And where are the names from Interview with the Vampire?" I asked with mock indignation. "Verboten," he said with a little lift of the eyebrows. "They are not fictional. They are real. But I will tell you they are playing your video clips on Castro Street now. The mortal customers demand it. They toast you with their vodka Bloody Marys. The dance of Les Innocents is pounding through the walls."
A real laughing fit was definitely coming. I tried to stop it. I shook my head.
"But you've effected something of a revolution in speech in the back room as well," he continued in the same mock sober fashion, unable to keep his face entirely straight.
"What do you mean?"
"Dark trick, dark gift, devil's road. They're all bantering these words about. The crudest fledglings who never even styled themselves vampires. They're imitating the book even though they condemn it utterly. They are loading themselves down with Egyptian jewelry. Black velvet is once again de rigueur."
"Too perfect," I said.
"But these places, what are they like?" "They're saturated with the vampire trappings," he said. "Posters from the vampire films adorn the walls, and the films themselves are projected continuously on high screens. The mortals who come are a regular freak show of theatrical types. Punk youngsters, artists, those done up in black capes and white plastic fangs. They scarcely notice us. We are often drab by comparison. And in the dim lights we might as well be invisible. Velvet and Egyptian jewelry and all. Of course, no one preys upon these mortal customers. We come to the vampire bars for information. The vampire bar is the safest place for a mortal in all Christendom. You cannot kill in the vampire bar."
"Wonder somebody didn't think of it before," I said.
"They did think of it," he said. "In Paris, it was the Théâtre des Vampires."
"Of course," I admitted.
He went on. "The word went out a month ago on the Vampire Connection that you were back, and the news was old then. They said you were hunting New Orleans, and then they learned what you meant to do. They had early copies of your autobiography. There was endless talk about the video films."
"And why didn't I see them in New Orleans?" I asked.
"Because New Orleans has been for half a century Armand's territory. No one dares to hunt New Orleans.
They learned through mortal sources of information out of Los Angeles and New York.
I didn't see Armand in New Orleans, I said.
I know, he answered. He looked troubled, confused for a moment. I felt a little tightening in the region of the heart. No one knows where Armand is, he said a little dully, but when he was there, he killed the young ones. They left New Orleans to him. They say that many of the old ones do that, kill the young ones. They say it of me, but it isn't so. I haunt San Francisco like a ghost. I do not trouble anyone save my unfortunate mortal victims.
All this didn't surprise me much.
There are too many of us, he said, as there always have been, and there is too much warring, and a coven in any given city is only a means by which three or more powerful ones agree not to destroy each other and to share the territory according to the rules.
The rules. Always the rules, I said.
They are different now, and more stringent. Absolutely no evidence of the kill must ever be left about. Not a single corpse must be left for mortals to investigate.
Of course.
And there must be no exposure whatsoever in the world of close-up photography and zoom lenses, of freeze-frame video examination. No risk that could lead to capture, incarceration, and scientific verification by the mortal world.
I nodded. But my pulse was racing. I loved being the outlaw, the one who had already broken every single law. And so they were imitating my book, were they? Oh, it was started already, wheels set into motion.
Lestat, you think you understand, he said patiently. But do you? Let the world have but one tiny fragment of our tissue for their microscopes, and there will be no arguments any more about legend or superstition. The proof will be there.
I don't agree with you, Louis, I said. It isn't that simple.
They have the means to identify and classify us, to galvanize the human race against us.
No, Louis. Scientists in this day and age are witch doctors perpetually at war. They quarrel over the most rudimentary questions. You would have to spread that supernatural tissue to every microscope in the world— and even then the public might not believe a word of it.
He reflected for a moment. One capture, then, he said. One living specimen in their hands.
Even that wouldn't do it, I said. And how could they ever hold me? But it was too lovely to contemplate. The chase, the intrigue, the possible capture and escape. I loved it. He was smiling now in a strange way. Full of disapproval and delight.
You are madder than you ever were, he said under his breath, madder than when you used to go about New Orleans deliberately scaring people in the old days.
I laughed and laughed, but then I got quiet. We didn't have that much time before morning, and I could laugh all the way into San Francisco tomorrow night.
Louis, I've thought this over from every angle, I said. It will be harder to start a real war with mortals than you think.
And you're bound and determined to start it, aren't you? You want everyone, mortal or immortal, to come after you.
Why not? I asked. Let it begin, and let them try to destroy us the way they have destroyed their other devils. Let them try to wipe us out.
He was watching me with that old expression of awe and incredulity that I had seen a thousand times on his face. I was a fool for it, as the expression goes. But the sky was paling overhead, the stars drifting steadily away. Only precious moments we had together before the early spring morning.
"And so you really mean for it to happen," he said earnestly, his tone gentler than before.
"Louis, I mean for something and everything to happen," I said. "I mean for all that we have been to change. What are we but leeches now, loathsome, secretive, without justification? The old romance is gone, so let us take on a new meaning. I crave the bright lights as I crave blood. I crave the divine visibility. I crave war."
"The new evil, to use your old words," he said. "And this time, it is the 20th century evil.
Precisely, I said. But again, I thought of the purely mortal impulse, the vain impulse for worldly fame, acknowledgement. Faint blush of shame. It was all going to be such a pleasure.
But why, Lestat? He asked a little suspiciously. Why the danger? The risk? After all, you have done it. You have come back. You're stronger than ever. You have the old fire as if it had never been lost. And you know how precious this is, this will simply to go on. Why risk it immediately? Have you forgotten what it was like when we had the world all around us, and no one could hurt us except ourselves?
Is this an offer, Louis? Have you come back to me, as lovers say? His eyes darkened, and he looked away from me. I'm not mocking you, Louis, I said.
You've come back to me, Lestat, he said evenly, looking at me again. When I heard the first whispers of you at Dracula's daughter, I felt something that I thought was gone forever.
He paused. But I knew what he was talking about. He had already said it, and I had understood it centuries ago when I felt Armand's despair after the death of the old coven. Excitement, the desire to continue, these things were priceless to us. All the more reason for the rock concert, the continuation, the war itself.
Lestat, don't go on the stage tomorrow night, he said. Let the films and the book do what you want, but protect yourself. Let us come together and let us talk together. Let us have each other in this century the way we never did in the past. And I do mean all of us.
Very tempting, beautiful one, I said. There were times in the last century when I would have given almost anything to hear those words. And we will come together, and we will talk, all of us, and we will have each other. It will be splendid, better than it ever was before. But I am going on the stage. I am going to be Lelio again the way I never was in Paris. I will be the vampire Lestat for all to see, a symbol, an outcast, a freak of nature, something loved, something despised, all of those things. I tell you, I can't give it up. I can't miss it. And quite frankly, I am not the least afraid. I braced myself for a coldness or a sadness to come over him, and I hated the approaching sun as much as I ever had in the past. He turned his back to it. The illumination was hurting him a little, but his face was as full of warm expression as before.
"Very well, then," he said. "I would like to go into San Francisco with you. I would like that very much. Will you take me with you?"
I couldn't immediately answer. Again, the sheer excitement was excruciating, and the love I felt for him was positively humiliating. "Of course I'll take you with me," I said. We looked at each other for a tense moment. He had to leave now. The morning had come for him. "One thing, Louis," I said.
"Yes?"
"Those clothes."
"Impossible.
I mean, tomorrow night, as they say in the 20th century, you will lose that sweater and those pants." The morning was too empty after he had gone. I stood still for a while, thinking of that message. Danger. I scanned the distant mountains, the never-ending fields. Threat. Warning. What did it matter? The young ones dial the telephones. The old ones raise their supernatural voices. Was it so strange? I could only think of Louis now, that he was with me, and of what it would be like when the others came. 2. The vast, sprawling parking lots of the San Francisco Cow Palace were overflowing with frenzied mortals as our motorcade pushed through the gates, my musicians in the limousine ahead, Louis in the leather-lined Porsche beside me. Crisp and shining in the black-caped costume of the band, he looked as if he'd stepped out of the pages of his own story, his green eyes passing a little fearfully over the screaming youngsters and motorcycle guards who kept them back and away from us. The hall had been sold out for a month. The disappointed fans wanted the music broadcast outside so they could hear it. Beer cans littered the ground. Teenagers sat atop car roofs and on trunks and hoods, radios blaring "The Vampire Lestat" at appalling volume. Alongside my window, our manager ran on foot, explaining that we would have the outside